You're listening to C2Y Podcast. We bring you discussions on child and youth care that feature conversations with young people, parents, and professionals about the youth social service system. Introducing your host, Wolfgang Vachon.
Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. I'm Wolfgang Vachon. Today, we're discussing death. Some young people we work with die, and some young people's caregivers die. Supporting children, youth, and families facing death is a difficult process. How do we support? What do we need to know in order to be effective? How do we take care of ourselves? As I was preparing this podcast, I realized this was far too much to cover in one episode. As a result, we're going to split this interview into two different podcasts. The first one will focus on supporting children whose caregivers are dying or who has died. The second, to be posted October 29th, will focus on the death of young people. This conversation will be rooted in the assumption that we are dealing with individual deaths and that there is a functioning infrastructure to support those who are going through the process. I say this thinking about what is currently happening with Ebola, death in the context of war, and what has happened over the past 30 years with HIV/AIDS. Our guest today is Dr. Mary Vachon. Dr. Vachon is a registered nurse, PhD, psychotherapist in private practice with a focus on death and dying. She has been working in this area since the late 1960s and has published over 170 scientific articles and book chapters in the areas of bereavement, occupational stress in healthcare professionals, dealing with life-threatening illnesses, and spirituality, among other related topics. Welcome, and thank you for joining us, Dr. Vachon.
You're welcome.
Death and dying is a very difficult area for many people, yet you've dedicated your life to it. What led you to spend your career in this area?
I suppose the first thing would be three major significant deaths that I had when I was young. The first was my brother's death when I was three, and we were in a family car accident and he was killed. The second was my young uncle's death. He was sort of a big brother to me, and he died going to babysit when he was 22, and then my grandmother's death when I was 15. But recently, in some meditations that I was doing, I came to understand that whereas I had often thought I focused in the area of death and dying because of my brother's death, with this meditation, I came to understand that another part of the reason for my focusing on this area was because my father had multiple losses, both as a young person and in his latter years. And his father died when he was 12. He witnessed his mother dying in childbirth, giving birth to his stepsister when he was 17, and his whole life was disrupted. And then his stepbrother was the one who was killed in this car accident. And then my brother was killed. And my father was driving. And so I came to realize that, in fact, much of my early childhood had to do with living with my father's anger, which could be quite explosive at some times. And I came to realize that there was a part of me that, in fact, was doing this work not only because of my own experience with death, but my own experience with loss and grief and anger and unresolved grief when I was a child. And I just realized that in the last couple of years. Another, more specifically, I became involved with death and dying in Canada. Well, first of all, I did my nurse's training at Mass General in Boston, where a lot of the early work on grief had been done. And so I learned a lot about grief, and a lot of early work was being done around death and dying with Dr. Avery Weissman and Tom Hackett at Mass General when I was there. So I was exposed to that. And then when we moved to Toronto, we became friendly with a couple at church, and they had four kids. And we had our son. And when we became friendly, one day the woman wasn't there. And I asked her husband where she was, and he said, she's in the hospital with a bleeding nose that won't stop. And the next week she was still in the hospital, and I said to my husband, I think we should get close to these people. I think they're in trouble. I think something bad is going on here. And sure enough, she had cancer that had recurred. She had had cancer when she was pregnant with her fourth child, and now it had recurred, and she was going to die. And I asked the psychiatrist with whom I was working how I could be helpful to this young woman who was 37 and going to be dying, leaving four young kids from 4 to 12, and the kids and her husband. And he said, I don't know, but if you're interested in that sort of thing, why don't you go over to Princess Margaret, because they're looking for somebody to work with the nurses about their feelings with dying patients. And so that was the start. So sort of reaching out to someone, having my own past experiences, led to my whole career.
That woman who that you met in church, who ended up dying with four children, ages 4 to 12, how did her children respond to her death?
Well, that's it's a tricky question. And each of the children responded in different ways. You know, one of the things that can happen is that an oldest child may sometimes assume a maternal role with the other children and may also assume sort of a spousal role with the remaining partner. And when my friend went on to marry someone that I had introduced him to, the oldest child had particular difficulties, and there was real resentment, and eventually this older child wound up getting into serious difficulty and is quite estranged from the family. And you see these issues happening sometimes.
And do different children, presumably children of different ages, are going to respond to death differently, not just birth order, but also different ages?
Absolutely.
What sort of responses might, you talk about 4 to 12, what's the, I mean, you talked about how that young woman or that girl at that point in time responded. What was the response, or maybe we should, you know, remove it from that specific situation. What are some responses of a four-year-old to the death of a mother or a parent?
Well, we can talk in generalities, and then each kid is going to be specific. So, you know, there's an old theory that if you lose someone between two, well, when I say lose, it can be to death, but it can also be, say, if parents split up when a child is between 3 and 6, one hypothesis is that the child feels very responsible for whatever bad has happened. And sometimes you will get a kid who becomes the very best little kid in town, you know, which happened to me. I mean, I was the oldest in a very big family, but I became, you know, the saint, and I was doing all the good stuff. And then my next brother and sister, in contrast, because you get contrast in families, they were the ones who acted out. And so if there's a death between 3 and 6, sometimes you feel responsible. And that can be a lifelong issue. You know, the whole concept now that many of our ideas about ourselves as people are laid down before we ever really have words. You know, a child may not even be able to express what he or she is feeling, but lo and behold, you know, they act it out in many ways. So, for example, I think in terms of a young child, and he was 5 when his mother brought him to my office several years ago, and as we started to talk about his mother's cancer, he crawled under her chair, and she said, you know, this is most unusual. This is, you know, not the child that I know, and I'm not sure what's going on. Well, I mean, he was then able to say that he felt that she was sick because of him, and that he had brought a cold home from school, and then the next thing you knew, there was, you know, his mother was sick, and so he assumed that it was because of him that she had this cancer. And then, you know, we hopefully resolved some of that issue. But, you know, it was then very challenging when his mother died. And it was particularly challenging because both of his parents died within just a few months of each other. And, you know, these are some of the kinds of issues that you can have. So he was probably about 7 when he had lost both of his parents.
And what happened to him after both? Where did he go after both his parents died?
Well, both he and his brother went to live with a brother of theirs in a sort of reconstituted family. And that had huge challenges for everybody. You know, they have turned out to, you know, be quite functioning members of society, but it was very rough, and there was a lot of difficulty between the siblings about the parents' death and about the whole way in which their life changed as a result of this.
And other than you, was there a support network? So many people who listen to this podcast are people who work in the social services, you know, and was there a support structure around them of service providers who recognized this is perhaps what's going to happen during the grieving process and this is to be expected, and people who were competent to work with the family?
Well, this is an old story, you know, which has shaped me in many ways. And I certainly tried dealing with some of these issues before the mother died, and the mother died fairly suddenly. And the plans that were made did not work. And so, you know, there were certain plans of what would happen with the boys when she died, and that didn't happen. And so there were professionals involved, but fairly quickly the family decided that they didn't really want these professionals involved and that they would do things in their own way. And that's not always a bad thing. There is a lot of talk in the grief field about, is grief counseling helpful? And there's no question. For many people, grief counseling can be extremely helpful, but sometimes to have people struggle things out in their own way works well as well. So not everybody is going to need grief counseling. The other thing that is probably the most important concept to remember about kids is, regardless of what the age is of kids when a parent dies, they are not going to finish their grieving. And their grieving is going to need to be redone at numerous other points in your life. You know, so the death of my brother when I was 3 is something that, you know, I would re-grieve, re-experience some of those losses at different points in my life. But for example, the death of a parent. So you have the death of a parent when you're young, and then when you're a teenager, you're left with this other parent, and you think, oh my God, if it was only if the parent who has died can become a saint, and, you know, if it should have been this parent who died and the other one should still be alive, and I would be able to have a good relationship with this other one that I can't have with this one. And, you know, you graduate from high school or you graduate from primary school and everybody else has 2 parents and you have 1. You know, go on to have a child, you go on to get married, and you can be consistently missing that parent at different points
in
your life.
And is it particularly connected to milestones like graduations and weddings? And
I think of it as milestones are a time when you might particularly feel it, but that's why I also mentioned the whole thing with adolescent angst, and, you know, adolescents obviously are going to have problems with parents. And then you have the situation of, if you're fighting with the parent who is there, you may well feel it would have been much better, you know, if this parent died, you know, the one that's alive, if that one died and I was left with the other one. You know, from the perspective of, you know, different challenges at different times.
There's a few things I want to return to.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is, you know, going back to that that young woman whose five-year-old son crawled underneath her chair.
Mm-hmm.
You know, going back to that woman you started the story with who had the consistent nosebleeds, how mm-hmm. do parents, with support or without support, prepare their children for their imminent death?
Well, you know, ideally, parents are going to talk to their kids about the fact that they love them, that nothing that they have done, that the kid has done in any way is responsible for the parent's death. You know, if parents have a belief in an afterlife, they may share that belief with their children. Hopefully, parents think through what they would like done with their kids and speak with the other parent, for example, or speak with whoever are going to be the caregivers about what they would like. It's often good if you put that into writing. One of the things that one of my friends and colleagues, Dr. Harvey Chachanov, has done is something called dignity therapy. And he has a series of questions that can be asked of somebody who is dying. They can be interviewed, and answer these questions. And this can be, what Harvey's work did was to transcribe that, and then the person could look over it and could make any changes. What I've done is to audio tape or videotape these sessions. And so in these sessions, the parents talk, but this can be people of any age, talk about their life experiences. What are the times they felt most alive? What are the things that they hope other people remember? What are the wishes that they have for the people who are surviving? And so you can leave this kind of legacy for kids. Sometimes parents will leave cards and gifts for kids to be opened each birthday or each Christmas. That can be great, but it can also have a certain amount of difficulty with it. I remember in my very early days, and this was before people were doing this kind of work, I suggested to a man who was going to be dying and leaving a 2-year-old and an 8-year-old, I suggested that he write a letter to his kids. And many years later, when I saw his wife, she said, you know, she had told the son that there was a letter to be read when he was 16. And she said, you know, I wish I had never told him that, because my son is a great kid, but he's not the kid his father wanted him to be. And this letter is essentially written to a kid who's very different from who my kid is. And so she said, I'm afraid it's going to cause more problems than it will be helpful. You know, so these kinds of legacies can be helpful. In a situation where I was working with a woman who was going to be dying and her kids were going to be going to live with her ex-husband, who had, shall we say, really not assumed a very good role in parenting and, you know, sufficiently such that, you know, he was prepared to go to jail rather than support his kids, and the kids were going to be going to live with him. I did an interview with the mom, but then I suggested that she say some good things about the father in the video, which was difficult for her to do. But, you know, in view of the fact that her kids were going to be living with this guy, you know, it was going to be important that there be at least some good things said by their mother about their father.
What happens if there's not the opportunity to prepare for the death? If people don't know it's going to happen, if it's a sudden death,
mm-hmm.
how does that change things for the surviving family members, for the children, for the spouse, if there is one?
Well, you know, sudden deaths are often, you know, extremely difficult because no one is prepared for them. But even a death after an illness can be seen as sudden. One of the issues that can happen with a sudden death is sort of changes in one's assumptive world. This is a term that was coined by my friend and colleague, Dr. Colin Murray Parks. And you assume that life is going to unfold in a particular way. And, you know, when daddy goes off to work in the morning, you assume he is going to come back. If you have a fight with daddy before he goes off to work, you assume when he comes back, you'll be able to resolve these issues. And when he doesn't come back, then you have all kinds of feelings of guilt and disbelief. You know, frequently with a sudden death in particular, people will have great difficulty believing that this death actually has happened and will fantasize that he's just gone off, which is why it can sometimes be helpful to actually see the body of someone who's died. But I remember one of the young people I worked with many years ago, she was 12 when her mother was dying, and her mother was in a wheelchair, and she was being very, very difficult with her mother as the mother was sick. And she said to me one time, "Do you know why I'm so difficult with my mom?" And I said, "No, you know, I and lots of people are wondering because you're really challenging her." And she said, "Well, that's because I know that she isn't really sick. You know, I know that they're telling me that she's sick and she's going to die, but I know she really doesn't want to be with us. And when they tell me that she's died, I'm going to know it's that she's left. And so I'm being really nasty and difficult with her because I know if I'm really bad, she's going to get up out of that chair and come and hit me. And so that's why I'm being so bad." And the mother actually died at home, so the girl was able to see her mother dead at home, so she knew it wasn't just that she had left. But then after the mother died, the girl had great difficulty and smashed all the windows in the house and just had huge challenges with all of the feelings that she had, having heard her mother say ahead of time, you know, "I don't know, you kids are driving me crazy," or "I'd be better off dead," or whatever the mother had said in an angry episode, and now the kid was paying the price.
You've talked about a variety of behaviors that we see. Would those be, and earlier you talked about not everyone needs grief counseling. Would you say that those who display externalizing behaviors, you know, meaning smashing windows, you know, stealing things, getting into fights, et cetera, are people who do need grief counseling? Is there a way to know who needs grief counseling for service providers who are trying to support individuals whose parents have died?
Well, I mean, certainly kids who are not wanting to deal with it probably need grief counseling. You know, anybody who is externalizing that behavior, certainly we would do well to offer them grief counseling. One of the things is to connect with kids and to try to be a helpful person. I think in terms of a young girl who was 15 when her mom was dying, and the mom wanted me to talk with her, and the daughter had no interest in talking with me, but I tried to be a friendly, caring person. And a year and a half after the mother died, I got a call from this daughter, and I thought, oh, okay, so this is good. Obviously, she saw me as somebody that she could contact. And she came to me because she had just been caught stealing a lipstick at a Shopper's. And the police let her off and said, you know, "But if we ever catch you again, you know, we're going to throw the book at you." And she said, and she came to me saying, "I've been stealing since my mother was diagnosed. I stole all of the clothes. My whole wardrobe has been stolen. I stole all of the clothes that I wore to my mother's funeral. I've stolen most of the things that are in my closet." And the fact that I had tried to be a neutral, supportive person, not forcing her to talk previously, then allowed her to come when she really was in big trouble.
That, I mean, that's such a beautiful story of the concept of acceptance. And as a care provider, your job is to support the individual so that, mm-hmm. you know, that when they are ready, you can. Mm-hmm. We're going to change topics in a moment, sticking with the idea of death. But is there anything else that you think is particularly important to discuss regarding the death of a caregiver before we move on to the death of a young person?
Well, I suppose to recognize that when you're really young, when a parent dies, if you're really young, between 3 and 6, you're going to be really, really vulnerable. And if you're a teen and your parent gets sick and dies, it's going to be really tricky. And teens need to really be supported. Everybody needs to be supported, but teens often because they're involved in separation and individuation, are going to have not been involved frequently in the parental situation, in the parental illness and death, and then may wind up with huge feelings of guilt about this. One of the things that I often suggest is that people write about what happened around the illness and death. And I say this in part because one of my clients had both of her parents die by the time she was 19, and she felt that she was okay when her father was dying, but that she was really bad when her mother died when she was 16. And then she found her diary, which documented how she had tried to be supportive to her mother. And it was so helpful to her in her 50s to find this diary. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I really suggest that people write down some of the things that happened. The other thing I suggest is that when someone has died and if people are feeling guilty, that they write a letter to the person who's died with all the feelings and such that they have, and then get a new piece of paper or a new document in the computer and empty their mind and let the person write back to them. Mm-hmm. And that can sometimes be very helpful.
Thank you very much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
We're going to continue on with our conversation, and I appreciate immensely all that you've said. It gives us a lot to think about in dealing with the death of a caregiver.
This concludes this month's episode of C2Y Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher, and visit us at c2ypodcast.org.